So we'll keep the introduction, Miksat Shvacho Lefanach, just a little bit, but say it's a pleasure to welcome Yosefa Rubel, I guess, for her inauguration to Torah in Motion. It's a pleasure to have you. Yosefa got her PhD from Bar-Ilan University in Bible. She teaches at Matan, as you heard, and at Bar-Ilan, at Herzog College, and she, I believe, is in the process of becoming a Yoetzet Halakha. So it's a pleasure to welcome here for a five-part series on Shir HaShirim, the Megillah of Pesach, which is rarely studied in depth. So this will be, you know, partially in depth, and Vakasha, we're looking forward to your series. Okay, let's get started.
Thank you so much. So I'll just give a little bit more of just a personal greeting. I'm speaking to you from what is right now very, very stormy Efrat. And I also just wanted to say that sometimes there's internet issues. So if for some reason I go out for whatever reason, I have a backup at next door. So give me 2 minutes and I'll be back on. But we've had some issues lately and a technician came, but we're expecting snow, actually, which is not a big deal for you. It'll probably be like 7 flakes, but we are expecting snow. So basically the country, which is already shut down, is going to shut down even more probably in the next 24 hours. So with that introduction, I'm speaking to you here from Efrat. I am the daughter of Sharon Usher, my mother, who is here in the audience, married to Zevi. We have 4 daughters, Baruch Hashem. And I'm very excited to be here. Shir HaShirim, and this makes no sense, but it was the first book that I ever thought to teach. It makes no sense because you don't usually start with biblical poetry when you're first starting out trying to teach Tanakh. But it was the first book that I ever tried to teach many, many, many years ago. And I'm so happy to have the chance to circle back to it and share with you some thoughts of mine that have changed over the years and some things that still are the same. And please God, what we're going to be doing is we're going to today really give a very, I would say, in-depth introduction to the book, to its unique challenges, to the ways that one can study it. And one thing that I will be in every class we will have is I'm going to be bringing in songs, some of them mostly modern, but songs that are using the words of Shir HaShirim, mostly Israeli songs. And I just find it to be a really, really fun way to see how the words are continually interpreted. And so we'll see 2 today, Bezrat Hashem, and every class we'll definitely have 1. There's some really wonderful modern Israeli singers who've made some phenomenal usage of words from Shir HaShirim. So we'll see them come to life in that way. And the way that the course is going to be structured, the mini course, is that we're going to have 5 classes. As I said, today is largely introduction with also attention given to the first unit of Shir HaShirim. And then we'll have 4 more classes and we'll really try and get, and we will get a very good sense of what the book is, even though we won't study every single word of its 8 parakim. And through that, we'll really have a sense of what this book is. It's something that we often just gloss over. It's very poetic and very unusual. And so without any further ado, I'm going to share with you our PowerPoint for this evening. Give me 1 second. Okay, so I hope you all got my Tina Turner reference over here. So here is our introduction to Shir HaShirim. Now, to be really, really brutally honest, we have a question of why is this book in Tanakh? Okay, now I want you to, for this class, erase whatever it is that you do know about Shir HaShirim until now. We will get to all of those things that you do know or have heard over the years. But I really want you to sort of just think with me and think and feel with me as we sort of go through a bit of an introduction to the book. At first glance, Shir HaShirim is a very, very odd fit among the tapestry of the Bible. God is not mentioned in the book. You know, we're very famously, we talk about God not being present in Megillat Esther, but God is not present in Shir HaShirim. There is a melech, there is a king, although he's in the most plain sense, definitely not referring to God. There is overt erotic content in Shir HaShirim, overt references to women's chests, to all body parts. There is no religious over or undertone. It's non-existent. We have here love poems in their most basic sense shared between a woman and a man, the dod and the ra'aya. Ra'aya has never made it yet, but it's on my short list of favorite names for women from the Bible. I have other interesting names in our house, but that's not one of them, not yet. And there's a tremendous emphasis on physical beauty. Now that one maybe is a little bit less unusual. We're always told when we meet main female characters in Tanakh, we're told, of course, they're all beautiful, which is also important to note. And they're either beautiful or really smart or both. But there's just of shocking emphasis on physical beauty, both for the man and the woman, their teeth, their hair. And it's completely unusual. We have nothing like this in Tanakh. We'll see, not really, but we really have nothing in this kind of sense. And so we have this question, why is this book here? And this question is important to answer because many of you are already thinking, well, it's really a metaphor. So we'll get to that. But that's already a later stage. And I want us to notice that is part of the answer already. But first, before we get to the answer, we need to stay for a moment in the question and in the discomfort that this book really presents us with. By the way, I'll just say that I'm calling it a book, and we call it a Megillah because Shir Shirim is written on a klaf. It's written on a parchment, but it's a book in that sense, just like all other books of Tanakh. And so I want us to see this discomfort and how it's reflected in some of our sources. This is not a new idea. I'll just say, by the way, that it's, yes, 100%, I will give you a link to the slides. It's hard for me to do the chat and the way my computer is functioning. So I'm going to look at the chat every few minutes. So please feel free to write me. And every few minutes, I'll look at it and look at everyone's questions. So I want us to see what is one of the most central sources that deals with this discomfort surrounding Shir HaShirim and its place in the canon, in the biblical canon. Kol kitvei hakodesh mitamim et hayadayim. Shir HaShirim veKohelet mitamim et hayadayim. Okay, we have here a phrase, which is an important phrase to understand, which is that all of our holy books, or what scripture, that's what the word scripture means, all of our holy books make our hands impure. And the Mishnah goes out of its way to specify this is also true regarding Shir HaShirim and Kohelet. Now, what does it mean that it makes our hands impure? And for this, we need to understand a little bit of the backdrop, which is that they would store the parchments that were considered to be scripture, along with food that was dedicated as truma, okay, as tithes. And they would be stored together because they were both holy, and therefore only people who were already had been to the mikvah and that they themselves were tohurim would be able to touch it. But this created a problem that we can all imagine, which is that there were rodents. Okay, there were rodents who would get in to the storage places in the mikdash where they would store the parchments. And so the phrase came to be that if you touched a scroll that was considered holy enough to put in one of these cabinets, it would make your hands impure because we assumed it would be touched by a rodent who was trying to get in to the truma food. Okay, so everyone follow that logic? So you were being a scroll that renders your hands impure means that it was considered holy enough to put it next to truma food. Okay, but the part that really interests me in this source is the fact that it has to emphasize the fact that Shir HaShirim and Kohelet are also included in that. Okay, that is according to the first opinion in the Mishnah. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Shir HaShirim metameh et hayadayim, veKohelet mechloket. I'm gonna use a little laser so we can all see where I'm looking at in the source. Okay, I'm in the second bullet point over here. He says Shir HaShirim is in fact a holy book. Again, impurifies your hands is the word we use, but Kohelet is not. And then there's Rabbi Yossi, who says that Shir HaShirim is a machloket. Okay, and there's continuing machlokot here, debates that go on for a number of centuries, essentially. And they bring in more. Amar Rabbi Shimon ben Azai, Mikubani, Mipi Shivim, Vishnaim Skenim. All the Skenim all said that Shir HaShirim veKohelet Metamim et Hayadayim. And then we have Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva is the big defender of Shir Hashirim. He says, "Chas v'shalom lo nechlak adam miYisrael b'Shir Hashirim shelo titmat hayadayim." Ma pitom? He says, "There is no machloket surrounding Shir Hashirim. Of course, it's a holy book." She'en ha'olam kulo kedai b'yom shenitna bo Shir Hashirim liYisrael. There was no greater day for Am Yisrael from the day that we received Shir Hashirim as one of our holy books. Shekol haktuvim kodesh v'Shir Hashirim kodesh kodeshim. Okay, he says, "Im nechriku el al kohelet." He says, "Ma pitom? This is not just a holy book; it's the holiest of books." It's quite a statement. Okay, we're going to unpack it in a minute. He says, "If there's a machloket, it's about kohelet, not about Shir Hashirim." Now, this the answer or bottom line is not significant here. What I want us to see is the machloket itself. Now, notice that Shir Hashirim and Kohelet are both books that were written by Shlomo. Okay, Shlomo himself had ups, you know, had highlights and lowlights in his career. Most notably, he is one who also was heavily involved with women. We'll get back to that first pasuk in Shir Hashirim. And we have Rabbi Akiva being the great defender, and Rabbi Akiva himself, which is a separate shir, he himself is known for love, his love for Rachel, his love for Yerushalayim. Rabbi Akiva himself, love was dafka one of the virtues that is associated with him in all the stories we have about him in the Gemara. Now, but the point I want us to see here is that this was a debate, and it was a debate that went on for a number of centuries. What is this doing here? Kohelet, by the way, we can also understand, is a complex book because a lot of it seems pretty heretical. Okay, read it through again if you're not really sure what I'm talking about. Kohelet is not an easy book to digest either. Okay, and so this source is important, not because the conclusion is that it's a holy book, but what I want us to see is that this was a debate. Okay, and this was a debate whether it was going to be included in the canon or not. Okay, hold on 1 second. Just have a. Okay. And here I want us to see a little bit more about the discomfort. This is from what's considered to be Midrash Tanaim, very, very early Midrashic material, Avot Rabbi Natan. I want us to just see the last part here, okay? Barishona hayu amrim mishlei v'shir hashirim v'kohelet ignezu. Okay, that there was a time in our history where they said all of Shlomo's books need to be hidden away, lignoz, right? Like the Gniza. So that's Shir Hashirim, Mishlei, and Kohelet. Shehem hayu amrim mashalot ve'inam min haktuvim ve'amdu ve'ganzu otam ad shebao anshei knesset ha'gdola ve'pirshu otam. And so what the Midrash here is telling us, the Avot Rabbi Natan, is that they were included and then they were excluded. And then when anshei knesset ha'gdola came and they explained, or we'll see, they gave theological significance to these books, they were able to be included again. Okay, so it's sort of that all of Shlomo's books were a little bit taboo. They were in, they got excluded, and then they came back in. Now, these sources also, by the way, raise for us a lot of very, very important questions surrounding the process of canonization. Okay, people ask me about how I can fix myself that I'm more than a small square. The truth is that I don't know, but if someone has an answer to that, then please tell me. As far as I know, yeah.
You don't, yeah. When you share your screen, that's the way it always is, that you're
yeah.
Pyramid.
No, that's as far as I know.
If you press the little minus on the picture, it takes it away and it becomes a video camera. There's a plus on the left side and a minus on the right side. And if you press that minus on that picture of the face, it disappears.
One more time, where's the plus and the minus?
At the top of the picture in the corner, you have a little picture in the corner, you can just take it away.
I would just leave it as is, I think it's fine.
Okay, I'll try and work on that technology for next time, but I appreciate it. So it brings up very interesting questions about canonization. And what I'll say is that we largely have a very big black hole in Jewish history. We have two, by the way. One of them is the 70 years between the destruction of the first temple and the rebuilding of the second one. There's a lot of questions surrounding what actually happened there. And Chazal have a number of different approaches to how to look at that period of time. And another one is the process of canonization. How did we go from having books that were floating around, many more than made it into Tanakh, that we have it today, some of them make it into the Vulgate, which is the Christian Bible, to making it in and that being the end of the story. These are very, very big questions. But we do know is that Shlomo's books and Gilat Esther were books that were contended for a long time. They ultimately make it in, as you know. But there are others who were written possibly at similar times that don't make it in. Okay, so these questions are all sort of floating in the background, but we're just going to keep our eye focused for now on Shir HaShirim. Okay, so what we see here from Avot de Rabbi Natan is that once Anshei Knesset HaGdolah come in the picture and assign the book theological meaning, then they're able to keep it in Tanakh. Okay, and we'll come back to that point in a few moments. Now, a last piece from Rabbi Akiva, right? Rabbi Akiva, who said that this is Kodesh HaKodeshim and there is no holier day than the day that Shir HaShirim made it into Tanakh. He also says something else very important. And this relates to our little pina that we're going to have with songs from Shir HaShirim. Rabbi Akiva Omer, and here I'm at the bottom. Sorry, my laser disappeared. Rabbi Akiva Omer, Hamenanea Kolo B'Shir HaShirim B'Beit HaMishte. Somebody who sings the words of Shir HaShirim B'Beit HaMishte is more like a club in today's terms. Ve'oseh Oto K'min Zemer, and makes it into some sort of cheap erotic song, which is what he means. Okay, meaning he doesn't have a portion in the world to come. Now, I wanted, not in defiance of Rabbi Akiva, but I wanted just to show you an example what Rabbi Akiva was talking about, okay? This is a very well-known song. I won't play the entire thing. A beautiful song. Anyone who is not familiar with Idan Reichel, he's one of, sort of at this point, a classic modern Israeli singer. Okay. Let's see if this little technology thing will work here. Okay. La la la.
חיפשתי בין כל רחובות העיר העמוס השקרים הזאת ולא מצאתי. עצרוני השומרים הסובבים בעיר החאובי, כמעט ולא מצאתי אותו. מחלופה ממנו עד שאביאו אל תוך עירי, אל בית אמי וחדרי אל מיטתי. הנה חיפה רעייתי ושפתותי חודשני, שינייך לבנות אור הלבנה, מי זאת עולה מן המדבר מארץ רחוקה, נישאת כנף ציפור גדולה, הגיעה לביתי.
אוקיי. So Idan Reichel, in the beginning, by the way, this is the Idan Reichel Project CD, so there was a lot of cooperation with him and Ethiopian singers, and that was what you were hearing in the beginning. It's a love song. He takes the words from Shir HaShirim, very simply, he turns them into a love song. It's a great one, it's beautiful. But that was exactly what Rabbi Akiva was talking about. Okay, when we're gonna look at, there are many songs like that. There's a good song by HaTikva Shesh, if these names mean anything to anyone. We're going to look at songs that really highlight the theological part, and sometimes both of them together. But that really is what Rabbi Akiva was talking about, speaking about taking the words of Shir HaShirim, Hinach Yefa Rayati, you are my beloved, you are beautiful, and using it as a love song, okay, which this song certainly gets played in clubs all over Israel. Okay, that's just to have a sense. Sorry. Okay, now interpreting the book. Hold on one second. Okay. Sorry. Okay. So we have two ways to look at Shira Shirim, okay? First way on the left side is that it's a love story, okay? It's a series of poems. We'll see it's not one story. It's a series of poems, and they're love poems. Now, that is problematic in the eyes of Chazal and certainly in Jewish interpretation. And the route that they have gone down is that it's a love story, love poems that are meant to be an allegory for the love between God and the Jewish people. And as I said, that this is really the only way that Shir HaShirim can be can find its place in Tanakh. Now, I will tell you that if you look up academic books on Shir HaShirim in your local library, anyone goes to a local library anymore, Corona. But if you look up books on Shir HaShirim and they're academic, they don't bring in the allegory. Meaning some of us are maybe used to Art Scroll, which is translated with the allegory already in the translation, or others. But our interpretation, we'll see that we're gonna go along both planes at the same time. But I want us to understand that this concept that looking at these are love poems, but they can't really be just love poems, it's the only way that this book could find its way in Tanakh. Because while there might be a time and place for love poems in the world, that's not the point of Tanakh, okay? The point of Tanakh and the books in Tanakh are to be a commentary and on our relationship with God throughout history at different points in our human life. And that's the only way that this book could find a place. And that it needs to have theological relevance. And so there we have two characters. We have the Dod and the Re'aya. Okay, the Dod is the male, Re'aya is the female. And we will speak about the metaphor when we speak about the metaphor that the Raya is in fact the nation and the Dod, the male figure, is God. But you should know that Kabbalistic interpretations of Shir HaShirim actually say the opposite. And that's because in a Kabbalistic or a more mystical worldview, anything feminine is actually representing God, because God is the Shekhinah and the Shekhinah is feminine. So we're going to go along those lines where the Raya, the woman, is Am Yisrael. But just know that depending on the interpretation, there are different ways to look at the metaphor itself. And before moving on, I want us to see that while it's true that Shir HaShirim is unusual, very unusual for all the reasons that I brought up before, that it was definitely unusual among other books of Tanakh, there are references to related things in Tanakh, okay? Now, what do I mean here? First, I want us to see the Rambam, okay? V'ketzad hi ahava reuya. Okay, here we have the Rambam. It's a famous source in the Rambam whenever anyone's learning Hilchot Tshuva. It's you know, of the Rambams out there, it's one of the ones that's quoted more often. V'ketzad hi ahava reuya. Who she ohav et Hashem ahava gedola yitera rabba azad meod ad shetei nafsho kshura ba'avat Hashem v'nimtza shoge batamid ki'ilu chole ahava she'en da'atam pnuya me'avat ota isha shehu shoge batamid. And he says that our obsession with God, our obsession constantly thinking about God, is something that we can parallel to when somebody is in their, I would say their falling in love space with here he's talking about a woman, right? When someone is falling in love with a woman and he's full of oxytocin in the initial falling in love stage, you can't think about anything else. We know this, by the way, anyone who wants to, a really wonderful researcher that I love, Helen Fisher, talks about the science of falling in love, literally how our brain functioning is impaired when we are in a falling in love state. They looked at people under fMRIs. It's totally true. Literally like portions of your brain are shut down. And so he says that is how we're supposed to feel about God. Just like we are obsessed with somebody when we fall in love with them, whether again, a romantic partner, or we can have sort of that romantic stage of a friendship. Ben b'shachvo, ben b'komo, ben b'shashu ochel b'shote, right? You can't go anywhere without thinking about her. Yeter mizeh tiyah avat Hashem b'lev ohavav, v'shogim batamid. And he says, and he quotes here at the bottom, והוא ששלמה אומר דרך משל, כי חולת אהבה אני, בכל שיר השירים משל הוא לעניין זה. And he said, how does the Rambam interpret Shir HaShirim? He says, all of Shir HaShirim, which is all about, really, it really is about a love relationship between a man and a woman. He says, all of it is a metaphor for how in love or the trajectory of the relationship that one should have with God. Now, we often think about our relationship with God through the prism of Ahavat Hashem and Yirat Hashem, right? Fearing God versus loving God. Shir HaShirim is all about the trajectory of loving God. And this loving relationship knows a lot of ups and downs. It knows a lot of shifting throughout time. There's a mature stage. There's an immature stage. There's a back and forth stage. There's a lot of different phases. There are many different phases to the relationship, just like we have with humans. But the Rambam says, he says, this is the way that I understand Shir HaShirim, is that all of it is meant to be a metaphor for how we relate to God, which doesn't mean that every single sentence, and this is the piece I want us to take, it doesn't mean that every single sentence in the book has to have a direct nimshal for our relationship with God. Many of the commentators go that route, whether it's Rashi or Ibn Ezra or many other classic commentators. But he also means that the thrust of the Megillah, meaning the sense that we get, the emotions that it arouses in us, those can be parallel to our relationship with God. And that's an approach that we're really going to be taking in our Shiurim, where we learn the Psukim as they are and try and take from them the thrust of the relationship and how that can relate to our relationship with God. We'll also see, of course, some of the classic commentaries on the Midrashim that are offered, but it's that general sense that we can get that I really personally take from Shir HaShirim, that it's the waves, it's the dynamic nature of the relationship that for me personally is most instructive. And I think that while some of us gain insight and inspiration from taking each pasuk and breaking down the parable, I'll do that a little bit with you. For me, I really, as we read a unit of text and have a sense of what it gives us, have a sense of where they're holding in the relationship, that to me, I find can be particularly instructive on a theological level. And so I want to just stay here for a moment and speak about where love does come up in Tanakh. Meaning, as I've said, how unusual Shir HaShirim is in the landscape of Tanakh. There are a number of places where love and also particularly a human relationship is compared to the divine relationship as well. And so in that sense, the choice, and I'm calling it a choice, okay? Again, there are those who will say Shir HaShirim was written to be understood as a metaphor. I don't think I can go that far and say that. I just don't know. But the choice to interpret it in a Jewish lens is to interpret it as a parable for our relationship with God. But it's not the only place in Tanakh where this concept comes up. And that, I think, really anchors this kind of interpretation much deeper in Tanakh. We have a love poem at the beginning of Sefer Bereishit, and I think it should be understood as nothing less. And that's what we have on the right side of the PowerPoint. When woman is created from man, and that unbelievably paradigmatic process of him first being lonely, him wanting to look for a mate, her literally being taken from a piece of his side, emblematic, not necessarily emblematic of the fact that they are part of one whole. Again, romantic love is right there in Tanakh. You don't have to look to, you know, the later centuries and the pre-modern world. And man declares when he sees woman, "Vayomer ha'adam zot ha'pa'am etzem me'atzamai uvasar mibsari zot yikare isha ki me'ish lukacha zot." Okay, now we can, you know, maybe this wouldn't be what I want my husband to propose with. But what man says to woman is, he says, this time, okay, and Zot really points to the fact that this is a moment, a eureka moment for man right now. And it'll be a eureka moment for mankind forever, right? That moment when you see somebody or you spend enough time with them to be able to say, this is somebody that I want to spend the rest of my life with, will be a eureka moment until the end of time. That's the way we are wired. And he says, you know, you are flesh, you are part of my flesh, part of my bones. And he calls her Isha because she was taken from the Ish. Again, maybe it's not everyone's dream love poem, but the point that I want us to take from it is that it's right there in the beginning of Sefer Bereshit. This declaration of love is right there at the beginning of time. Okay. Now, the metaphor that God, a relationship with God is parallel to a relationship with a loved one, gains strength in the prophets, okay, gains strength in Nevi'im, but it's also all over the Torah, okay? Now, I invite you to think about where that might be. It's in a very particular relationship, and that is when we don't do well, okay? When we're warned about worshiping foreign gods, the word that's used always is the verb zana, okay, zayin nun hey, which literally means to prostitute. And it's constantly through Sefer Yoshua, Sefer Shoftim, it's all over the place that when we worship other gods, it's the same thing as committing adultery against God, okay? So that parallel is built in to our conception of how we can relate to God in the world. And I say this always in whatever I'm teaching, whoever I'm teaching, that we only have our human mind and our human relationships to work with in this world. Okay. Now some people, you know, do reach unbelievable spiritual heights and they are connected to something that is far beyond the human realm. But for most of us, our prism through which we can create a relationship with God are through the metaphors that we live with in our daily life. And loved ones and being faithful to our loved ones is a prism that we as humankind can relate to. And so that is the metaphor that is there, whether implicitly or explicitly, to refer to a relationship with God. It is like a relationship with a spouse, okay? And we'll speak about exactly what kind of traits we're talking about here. But I first want us to see also, to see a few psukim. We have from Yirmiyahu. Sorry, one second. My screen is being a little weird today. Okay. הלוך וקראת באוזני ירושלים לאמור. כה אמר אדוני, זכרתי לך חסד נעורייך, אהבת כלולותייך, לכתך אחריי במדבר, בארץ לא זרועה. Okay, here we have psukim that we know well. I just want us to point out this point that I've been trying to make. Here we're speaking, it's actually a beautiful poem in Yirmiyahu. There's a lot of really hard sections, but this is a beautiful one where God is calling out to the people that they should remember this beautiful, blissful period that they had with each other when we followed God into the desert. By the way, it's really lovely. This happens also in our relationships that over the span of time, you know, we tend to see things in a beautiful way. You know, the desert period wasn't really all that rosy. But in the way that it's being depicted here in Sefer Yirmiyahu, oh, whatever, you had some complaints, there were some plagues, there was some thousands of people dying here and there, but it was a beautiful period of blossoming love, right? Okay, so that's the beauty of looking at things from afar. Sometimes it's a little bit how I feel when people, you know, ask how your kids are, and, you know, your kids are little and they had kids a long time ago, and no one really wants to hear about how messy the day goes. Like, oh, kids, they're great. You know, okay, yeah, they're great. Another 10 years, I'll remember that on a daily basis. When you're in the struggle, it's a little bit different. And here the pasuk continues in Yirmiyahu. Lemor hen ishal, sorry, the pasuk is very small on my page. Hen ishalach ish et ishto vehalcha meito vehaita leish acher hayashuv elea od haloch chanof techanaf.
Now here we have all the elements that I was speaking about before. God is asking a rhetorical question. He says, you know, could it possibly be that if a man is estranged, can he go back to his wife?
you know, would that relationship would essentially be polluted. And God here is saying, you know, if you worship other gods, is it possible for you to return to me? Again, I really just want us to see that the prism of this metaphor is very much present here as well. Of course, a relationship with God and a relationship with another human requires trust and faith in one another and open communication, which we'll talk about very much as well in our study of Shir Shirim. There are so many, and there are also relationships that see up and down. They're not relationships that are smooth, that there are many different time periods, and the love grows as much as we can weather the storms while still remaining on good terms with each other. And that is a very important piece. I'll bring one more pasu, which is from Hosea. Again, another one of the Treyasar, one of the 12 prophets. V'haya b'yom ahu ne'um Adonai, tikri'i ishi v'lo tikri'i li od ba'ali. And this is a great proof text. There are women in Israel who don't call their husband Baal because it does have a uncomfortable connotation. And so they use the word ish, ha'ish sheli, which doesn't connote that they have any possession over them. This is where the idea comes from. And he says, you know, on that day when our relationship will be perfect, you will not call me Baal anymore. You will call me Ish. Another reason is because Baal is another word for the main Canaanite god for fertility. So the word itself has some weird connotations as well. V'hasiroti et shmot ha-ba'alim mipiha v'lo yizachru od bishmam. And he says, I will remove the names of all those other lovers you've had, i.e. the other gods. V'charti lehem brit, and I'll make a covenant between us. I'm skipping a little bit. In pasuk kaf aleph, v'arastich li leolam, the pasuk that people like to put on their wedding invitations, and I will be betrothed to you forever. V'arastich li b'tzedek u'mishpat, how are we betrothed to God? By committing ourselves to a life of righteousness, of tzedek and mishpat, u'v'chesed v'rachamim. Okay, and that also is important, that I will be betrothed to you in faith, which is another huge part of how we become connected to somebody. We have to put our faith in them. And that's why, of course, when there's breaches of faith, that a lot of times the relationship shatters to the point that we're not able to resuscitate it. And so that I want us just to see that, so that we have a sense of that this is not completely new. The idea that a love relationship can be parallel to relationship with God exists in Tanakh. It exists, as I said, in the basic language that we use to describe our adultery, okay, from God, we worship other gods. And also in some of these really beautiful texts that we have from the later prophets. Now, one more question to address before we jump right into the first unit. And that is how to understand Shir Shirim. If you read through Shir Shirim, you'll have a hard time coming away from it with any sense of a plot. Okay, it's not simple. There are those who have tried, but it's really not simple to come away from it saying that there was a beginning, there was a middle and an end. There are moments of culmination. There are moments of climax, but it's not literary in the sense of a narrative. It just doesn't exist. And so the question we have when we come to study the book of Shir Shirim is, do we look at it just as an anthology of poems, that it's just separate poems that just happen to be common characters and common themes to some of them? Or do we somehow weave from within these poems a sense of a literary whole? This is, I mentioned before, opinions of mine that have shifted over the years. I do think that it is largely separate poems, although I think that there are many themes that connect them and that they really shouldn't be overlooked. Efforts that have been made to look at it as sort of a whole and identify clear climax points and clear plot developments, I guess over the years I've had a harder time feeling that they really fit the sense of the text. But we're going to talk about that as we go along. And we're going to look at some of the main units that I think that we can look at them for what they are and come away with a very deep understanding of what is trying to be conveyed here. So when I say, are they separate poems or a literary whole?
I guess I hang out somewhere in between these two. That would be the honest answer. And so you'll see that as we go along. Okay, we're here. We've arrived at the opening, or what we call the koteret in Hebrew, really what we would call a title of Shir HaShirim. The phrase Shir HaShirim Asher LeShlomo is a phrase that only has four words, but it's not so simple to understand. And there's, I would say, four main understandings of what this phrase really means. Shir HaShirim in modern Hebrew means the best of the songs, okay? And so what that would mean is these, right, this is the greatest hits album. This is Shlomo's greatest hits album. That's what's been included in Shir HaShirim. Of all of the love poetry he wrote, which again, I'll remind us here that Shlomo was a king, the son of David, who reached unbelievable political power. He extended Israel to its full biblical boundaries. We are far away from those boundaries today. There are some other countries that are there in between. He extended Israel to its greatest boundaries. He experienced tremendous success. He also, like many, when you encounter tremendous power, he acquired many, many wives that ultimately, at the end of his life, steered him towards foreign worship. Which is a really big blow. It's a big blow as David. It's a painful piece. And as a result of that, it's sort of the beginning of the monarchy starting to fray. But we know that he was a poet and that he wrote a tremendous amount. And so this interpretation says that, again, as I said, Shir HaShirim, it's his best hits, right? Greatest hits of his love poems. Another approach would be to say that it's these Shir HaShirim, of all of the love poems out there in the world, this is the greatest one, and it was written by Shlomo. Again, it sounds like a little bit semantics, but it does somehow impact the way we understand the book itself. And then one last interpretation, this is where the Midrash takes us, if you look at the Midrashim, is that Shlomo, who is mentioned seven times in the Megillah, as a background character. He's not, you know, if assuming that Shlomo is definitely a writer, or at least a writer of a portion of Shir HaShirim, he does not give himself, front and center. He's not particularly present. He's named as the Melech. And here, according to the Midrash, this refers to God, okay, that these are songs, right? They're poems. In Hebrew, they're interchangeable, those two words. That these are poems that were written for Shlomo, here being a metaphor for God. Okay, so these were songs written for God, which, as you can understand, if you're looking at the metaphor, looking at Shir HaShirim as a metaphor, that's how one would interpret this pasuk, and that's indeed how the Midrash interprets it. When I say Midrash, by the way, I refer to many, many Midrashim, but there are general themes that show up in the Midrash. Okay, I want us to look at Rashi's introduction. As by way of looking at the first section of Shir HaShirim, I want us to look at Rashi's introduction to the book of Shir HaShirim. Now, this is, for those who study Parshanut, or exegesis, the methodologies of the Parshanim, or the commentators, this is one of the most important texts that we have for understanding Rashi's approach to commenting on Tanakh. It's what we call a programmatic statement. And it's a statement that doesn't come by very often by the commentators. They did their thing. They didn't really explain their thing. And so this is a very, very important text, but I want us to read it not for the importance that it has for those who study Rashi's approach to commentary, but for what it offers us and how to understand Shir HaShirim. I'm gonna take a moment to look at the chat and see if there's anything there. Okay, I'm seeing questions about the paging, and I'm going to stay afterwards at the end of class to be able to work it out better for next time. I'm just not going to take our time right now, but I see the comment, and I'm going to take time at the end to see if I can fix the screen and know how to do it better next time. This is always how I teach in other contexts, but if it's uncomfortable, I'm happy to learn something new. Okay. Rashi says, "Achat davar Elohim, shtaim zo shamati." Says, right? One thing is written. I hear two. It's a from Tehillim. Mikra achad yotze lekama ta'amim. V'sof davar en lecha mikra yotze midei pshuto u'mashmo.
Again, these are very important words for understanding Rashi's commentary, how he understands that there are many ways to interpret a pasuk, but that there needs to be a plain sense as well. But we're going to leave it on the side for now.
V'af al pi shedibru ha-nevi'im divrehem bedugma, and even though that the prophets speak in metaphor all the time, tzarich liyashev bedugma al ofna v'al sidra kamo she'amikraot sidurim ze achar ze. He says, but you can't just spend your whole time basically in what he's calling midrash. You have to also make sense of things. It needs to have some sort of order and plot.
And he says that I've seen many different midrashim about Shir Shirim, and here he explains how he's going to interpret the book.
Omer ani shira'a Shlomo beruach hakodesh she'atidin Yisrael liglot gola achar gola.
Okay, he says that Shlomo HaMelech, writing Shir Shirim, sees that Bnei Yisrael are going to go out into many exiles, okay, or some main ones.
Churban achar churban, destruction after destruction. Ulit onen begalut zol kvodam rishon,
and they're going to remember. Oi, oi, oi! What's the phrase we use today? Chadesh yemenu kekedem. They're going to remember why we wish we could restore the days of old.
Uliskor chibah rishona asher hayu skula mikol ha'amim,
and they are going to always go back to that point. Remember when we were God's chosen people, the skula. That was what I would call the oxytocin falling in love state. That's how Rashi's presenting it. They're always going to remember, but God chose us, and we were the chosen one. Here, by the way, you can read, if anyone's interested, you can look up Sarah Kamin, who was a Rashi scholar. He's speaking directly here to Christian polemics, but we're going to leave it on the side now as well. He's directly speaking to that dogma of being the chosen and then unchosen.
V'yised ha-sefer hazeh b'ruach ha-kodesh.
And he, in his divine spirit, was able to write this book.
B'lashon isha tzrura almanut chayut.
Okay, and he says, that who is the woman who speaks in this book? This is Rashi's very unique interpretation. He says the woman speaking is a widow. Okay, but the phrase almanut chayut is a widow whose husband is still alive. Now, some of us might say that sounds like an aguna. Okay, it's a phrase that comes up in Sefer Shmuel. And in Rashi's sense here, it's a woman who is no longer who is estranged from her husband.
Mishtokeket al ba'ala, mitirapeket al doda,
and she's sitting and she is yearning and she just wants to be reunited with him.
Maskeret ahavat ne'ureha elav,
and she keeps just going back. And she just has like that reel playing in her mind of the way the relationship was in its pristine, young stage that they were in. And so he says that all of Shir HaShirim, which is, you'll see, it's very, very immature love. It's really, really young people who don't have an established relationship with one another at all. It's definitely, definitely immature love. And he says that the woman who is telling the story, which is also Rashi's beautiful way of explaining to us that, yes, indeed, the narrator of Shir HaShirim is a female voice, which is why, by the way, some academics suggested it was written by a woman, which obviously goes against Chazal's interpretation, Chazal's opinion it was written by Shlomo. But that is why they say that, because there's such intimate references to female body that they assume, these academics, that only a woman would be able to write that. And he says that it's a woman remembering how beautiful her love was when they were young.
V'gam doda tzar lo b'tzarata u'maskir chastei ne'ureha v'noa yofia,
and she's remembering how great it was, how beautiful she used to be, v'chulei v'chulei, v'az u'mesayem, he ends here at the end,
ki od hi ishto v'hu isha.
Okay, that they're still married to each other.
V'hu atid lashuv eila,
and he will come back to her. Now, let's take a step back for a second. The metaphor for Rashi is that it's a woman who is now old and she's reminiscing about the early days of her love relationship with her husband, but they are estranged from each other. And for Rashi, that's the prism through which he looks at the galut. He says exile is a very long and very painful temporary separation between Am Yisrael and HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Okay, and so he says that's the way to reach Shir HaShirim, is that it's us, the woman, sitting in exile, remembering how good things used to be and how we will get back there when we leave our exile and return to and are redeemed, again, whatever that means, very, very broad phrase, but when we are redeemed in the future, then we'll be able to restore that relationship. And so for Rashi, all of Shir HaShirim is essentially a flashback. I'll just say that other commentators go in a very different direction. Okay, this is Rashi's, someone correctly said that it doesn't mean she's necessarily old. The reason I'm saying that she's old is because the exile is very long. And even when Rashi was writing in, you know, the 11th century, we had been in exile for a very long time. So the assumption for Rashi is that she is in fact elderly, but that's a good point. I have to look at Rashi's commentary all throughout to see it, but I'm pretty sure that he does refer to her being older, but it doesn't really matter necessarily. So other commentators look at things very differently, and we'll bring them as we go along. But I want us to see Rashi because, again, it brings us this point about the metaphor. And here we have directly the Rashi referring to that it's a remembering, it's a longing. Shir HaShirim is written as one big longing for God in the way that we used to have a relationship with Him. Now, in our remaining time, great, we're going to look at the first three psukim. Okay, of Shir HaShirim after the opening line that we saw before. Ishakeni, and by the way, I'm happy to stay for a few minutes after for questions. I'll stop exactly at 9:30, which for you is 2:30. Quick math by me, doctorate in Tanakh, not in math. So I'll stay on the Simcha for questions. Ishakeni meneshikot pihu ki tovim dodecha miyayin. Okay, now for those of us who, the laning of Shir HaShirim is beautiful. I guess I won't do it now because I guess there's plenty of men in the audience, but you can look also on YouTube and listen to Shir HaShirim. It's really beautiful. Now she's speaking here, the woman is speaking in what we call in Hebrew, Lashon Mish'ala. Okay, it's longing. We'll see in a moment, he's not there with her. She is not talking to him. When I first learned Shir HaShirim, and here I'll quote a teacher and a colleague called Tamidat Chavira, Shani Terrigan, when she taught me this so many years ago, she, and I'll use this metaphor only in her name, that she said it's a little bit like that scene in Greece, okay, where I don't even know what the characters' names are because I never really saw the whole movie, but I know there's the woman and there's John Travolta. In the beginning of the movie, there is a scene where she's singing, okay, right? The famous song, she's singing and he's singing and they're each with their friends, but they're in parallel screens. It was a very big cinematic feat then to have those parallel screens. They're in their parallel screens, but they're not talking to each other. That's what's happening now exactly, okay? She is fantasizing about this man who is not actually with her. Okay. And she says, how I wish I could be kissed with the kisses of his lips because his love acts, a dod here literally means a beloved, but dodecha in plural, hadodim shalcha literally means his love acts. Okay. Which we can imagine here again is referring to some sort of kissing because they're even greater than wine. Okay. Meaning wine, which is the thing that's the greatest that gets greater over time. And as it ages, it gets even better. And she's longing for the kisses of his lips. L'reach shmanecha tovim, shemen turak shemecha. And she moves from the sense of touch to the sense of smell. Okay, the smell of your oils is good. Shemen turak shemecha. That is. I'll also just remind us that in these times and many many centuries later, people weren't particularly fresh or bathed. And so using oils was their way of obviously smelling good and keeping themselves feeling fresher. Arken alamot ahivucha. Okay. And she says, because of this, because of your great smell, and because of your kisses, that many women love you. And so already in the opening of Shir HaShirim, we get the sense that she is one of many. She is fantasizing about him because she is far from being the only woman out there who fantasizes about this man. There are so many people so many women who are after him. And we'll see that she has a lot of self-confidence issues, that she is not at all confident that he's going to be interested in her. Moshcheni acherecha narutza min pasuk dalin, that if you will pull me after you, we will run. Okay. And there's a lot of changes here of grammatical changes from first person to third person to the collective plural of narutza. Okay. Which is why I've highlighted it. It says, if you pull me after you, we will run. Now, there's two ways to understand that. It could be that she says, we will run as a way of speaking somewhat more modestly, which you might say, what's the need? She's already talked about kissing him, which is definitely possible. But it also, you know, sometimes when we're embarrassed, we say we and not I, because we don't really want to say I. So there are those who think that that's what it could be here. But it also could be that she's referring to all the women who are looking to run after him. Okay, if you pull me, I'll run with all of us, right? We're all waiting here just for you to call us. And then she says, Havyani hamerech hadarav, that the king should bring me into his chamber. Nagila v'nismecha bach, naskira dodecha miyayin. Okay, that I will, you know, we will rejoice. Again, here we have the wheat. We will rejoice and be happy with you. And we will remember or cite how great your love acts are, how much greater they are than wine. Mesharim ahivucha. And again, she speaks about all of those around who also love him. Okay, Mesharim also here means is parallel to Alamot. That here we have again this sense of she has great longing for him, but so does everyone else. And so we walk in to this story. We walk into the dynamic between this woman and this king. Now we also have to ask, is he really a king, right? Is this seemingly simple woman, although we don't know yet for sure, but we'll see she's simple. She's a shepherdess. Is she really envisioning herself with the king? We often don't fantasize, and this is a little bit of a twist on Ibn Ezra, a comment that he makes on the Seret HaDibrot. We don't usually fantasize about things that are completely beyond our reach. It's not even fun to think about them because it just creates despair. And we'll see that this melech, this king, it's the way she's referring to him, but he himself is also a rather simple guy. He also is a shepherd. And so the phrase melech is referring to how glorious she thinks of him, right? How he's everything. He's the king. But he's not really necessarily the actual king. Of course, we're not going to look at it now, but of course the Midrash picks up on the places where it says Hamelech and interprets it as God. Okay, but we have here so far in this first little piece there's a fantasy on the part of the woman. We're going to see his response. It'll be far less enthusiastic than her desire. He'll get there eventually, but she is looking to connect with this man. She's looking to be with him, but the song switches, the poem switches from her being close to them, her being far, and her being close and wanting to smell and to touch him, to her being far and being part of the broader woman who is also looking for him. Now, I'm going to skip this last piece here, and I want to just end off. And again, I'll say the simcha and answer questions. Okay, and I just want to, this is a very, very, very different interpretation, okay? I was debating ending off with Holocaust. But the reason why I wanted to bring this is because it's taking with, I don't even think he knew Rashi. This is Hanan Yuval, who was kibbutznik. You can Google, you can Wikipedia him. Of the Meir Ariel generation. He's still alive. He's 77. But this is taking the words of Shir Shim, which are written here on the clip, and mamash, like Rashi, looking at it as speaking about the people in exile. Okay. And it's a love song, despite the horrors. I would have done away with the pictures for now, but I'm going to play just a little bit of it. But despite the horrors and the distance that we feel from God, that there is a desire to come close. And that's what Shir Shim is representing. Okay. So I'm going to play this also right now.
Oh, yeah, I never.
the share for a minute. I just wanted to, I think, first of all, I'll send out, someone asked me if I'm sending out the PowerPoint, 100%, I'll find out where I send that to. But I brought in that piece because any work that you see borrowing language from Shir Shirim, in itself, we could spend, you know, a whole class analyzing the text. But I'll just say in a few sentences that text takes the words of Shir Shirim, okay, and it speaks about how beautiful the woman is, even though, right, it says she hasn't had her hair combed and she doesn't have, you know, and again, speaking about women in the Holocaust who were living in, I don't even have to describe it, right, in living in under those conditions, that even so, that they were still beautiful, and that God in that song, the man is looking for his beloved, that he says, you know, have you seen her, right? And he also will speak about, don't forget me, okay? Now, this is a very particular interpretation where we're referring to, you know, at the darkest point in modern history, or perhaps history of all for the Jewish people, that love still exists in a very different form, but they will be reunited. And so I just think that song takes the prism that Rashi offers about the exile and really gives us a very real sense of what Rashi is talking about. So I encourage anybody who wants to go back and open up those links and hear them. Even Idan Rachel, I still like that song. So I just want to say thank you. And this is the beginning. And I'm gonna look at the chat now and answer any questions. Also feel free to unmute. I'm going to just open up the chat now, but thank you. Forever has to go. Bezrat Hashem, we will see you next week. And I will send the PowerPoint on to Jay and he'll put it wherever it has to go.
Sefa, can I ask you a question?
Yes, Ruth, yes.
So I was so moved by the way you lined up the opening, that opening scene in Bereshit, where Adam says, zot, 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 because I've always thought of it that way, but I never saw it aligned as the poem. And it is the connection when Yaakov wakes up in the morning and he sees Leah and he calls her Zot several times. And I've always felt that this was the divine author telling us she, Leah, is his Isha. She is the real Isha. She is his chief wife. And he didn't recognize it. He didn't understand, although Adam does.
Yeah. Yeah, thank you for pointing that out. I think that the dynamic between Yaakov is, he's our patriarch of struggle, right? Nothing is ever easy for him. Mm-hmm. But I think that there is a prominence that Leah has over Rachel, certainly in her dominance of the Shvatim. And I'll just speak to that one piece that you said and say that Leah is the one who's buried with Yaakov.
Exactly.
Not Rachel.
Exactly.
And
one more thing.
Yeah.
In that sequence there, when he wakes up and he sees her, it was Vayihi Ba'erev, she is brought to him. Vayihi Boker, Hine Leah. That's the by he era
creation. You're saying it's a nod to the creation narrative.
Yes, where we see Zot and Isha.
Yeah, that's beautiful. I don't think I ever thought of that. So thank you for sharing that. Yeah.
Right, he's from the
major. Yeah, I am going to send them. I'm responding again to the chats. I am going to send the. Hold on, I'm going to check that out. Yes, anybody, please unmute and ask me anything.
Are you familiar with the book by Geula Twersky and her approach to Shir HaShirim? It's different.
I can't say I've read it.
She has this thing about the whole book being about the Kruvim. And she supports that, but it's odd. I mean, it's different.
I mean, she lives a hill away. but I haven't read the book. I will say that just so that you all, you know, have it. very much connected to the academic world, meaning my influences are a real combination of all of our classical commentaries and academia. So that is definitely gets infused. I will say that my advisor for my doctorate, which had nothing to do with this, it's not something totally different, but my advisor, he wrote a commentary on Shir HaShirim. His name is Eli Assis. You can Google him. The more there's an academic version in English, there's a more, you know, for the rest of us folk in Hebrew version. You can Google it and see if you can find anything. I don't even at this point necessarily teach. He really sees all the units as being deeply connected in more of a plot. I think, as I said, I've moved away from that approach over the years. But there are many ways to look at Shir HaShirim. I think that it is. It's a very, very unusual book. And so everybody has, I personally think, by the way, that the most fascinating thing to do is to go back and read Rashi and Ibn Ezra and some of our commentators. They have such insightful interpretations of Shir HaShirim. And I think that sometimes when we read Rashi, let's say through the prism of English translations, it sometimes looks at Rashi a little bit superficially. Ibn Ezra, by the way, has four commentaries on Shir HaShirim. If you look at his commentary, he has four different levels through which he looks at it. And each level he offers something totally, totally different. Another person to check out if anyone's interested in a lot of reading for today, you could also Google Baruch Alster, A-L-S-T-E-R. He wrote his doctorate on, he took, I think, 12 commentaries on Shir HaShirim, meaning Jewish commentaries, and compared them, contrasted them. His name is Baruch Alster. Yeah. He lives here also. He lives in the Shomron. Anyway, so he wrote it in English. He's an English speaker in some level. I don't know. Anyway, so he also wrote, and he has like a really good overview. He also takes some anonymous manuscripts that were erroneously contributed to Rashi and Rashi students, and he also tries to date them, and he does good work. And he also has some articles online on a website called The Torah, which is a website that is not particularly traditional, mm-hmm. but he has some good articles on there that I don't think they'll ruffle anybody's theological feathers. They're just commentaries on Shir HaShirim.
Thank you.
Pleasure. Anyone else?
I don't think I ever learned Shir HaShirim, so this is a real treat for me. Actually, Kohelet I learned, you know, maybe a time and a half. I'm just wondering, you said something, it could be about the exile, but Shlomo predates the exile.
Right, so that's why Rashi says that he saw in Ruach HaKodesh that we would be exiled. Again, it's a
rationale.
There's a leap for sure.
Yeah, because it's also like you have in Tehillim. I mean, it used to be that everyone would say like a mantra that King David wrote Tehillim, but in actuality, it doesn't seem to make sense. And the more I've learned in various places, it wasn't.
Yeah, and, I mean, I would even say without,
like in his style, you could say, but yeah. It also deals with things that happened long after he died.
Yeah, so exactly. So look, this is a general question, and of course, the academic world has different answers to offer. But what Batya is saying is that you've been exposed over the years to teachers who are also influenced by that. But it's true that many of the plain sense of the verses clearly written in Bayit Sheni in Sefer Tehillim, or well into the exile of the first exile, you could say was written by David all through Ruach HaKodesh. There really isn't any real need to have to say that. Clearly, David wrote a very large chunk of Tehillim. That's the Masorah that we have. But there are also many others, B'nai Asaf, B'nai Korach, other families of people who wrote Tehillim. It's straight there in the Pesukim. I don't really understand why. You know, it doesn't need to be anything like earth-shattering. It says it right there in the Pesukim. And then, yeah, and then there are others who will go further and say that some of them were written later. Tehillim, by the way, speaking about Shir HaShirim being, you know, Shlomo's greatest hits, Tehillim is like the top 150 poems of all time in the Jewish tradition. That's what Tehillim is. It also should be looked at as an anthology. It's an anthology that has themes. It's an anthology that has different sections to it. But that's also exactly what Tehillim is. It's an anthology. Apparently, you know more than I do about Tehillim because you were all just in a class before this. So,
it's a whole idea of Galut as part of the Jewish experience of the love and separation is also mentioned in the Torah as a condition for us being in Israel and on our land. If we keep the Torah, and if we are not, then other Nevi'im already predicted, and the Psukim themselves, so the, mm-hmm. that it doesn't take a big leap to look at it as an experiential foreshadowing of something that might
I agree. I think that the themes are there. The themes exist already in the Torah that are being brought in here. Definitely.
That's the beauty of our liturgy. It can always be applied to any time of history.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right.
Right. And since we don't have Nevuah now, we're not used to, you know, we're just, since Nevuah is no longer in the world, it's, what did Batya say, a rationale. It's not necessarily a rationale. We just, since we don't have it anymore, it's just a little harder than it used to be to relate to it. It used to be easily relatable.
Yeah.
Till it left the world. Till the world went dark.
I'll tell you that Shir HaShirim, I think, is a wonderful book, Dafka, to learn as a teenager, because it's a great text. This is actually a great idea I just got right now. I have to teach a bunch of 18-year-olds tomorrow about this topic. This was a very good moment. Now I realize what my summary shiur is tomorrow for this group of students who I have to meet for the last time, unfortunately, on Zoom. That it's a great book to read as a teen, because they can really relate to a lot of the plain sense of the book, and it can draw them in. Actually, it's meaning we can be drawn in as older, more mature folk, through also remembering the plain sense and also the metaphor. And I also think it's a great book to learn when you're younger.
Right, especially you had said, Yosefa, that you can't, or that someone had said, you can't fantasize about something that you haven't had a little bit of a taste of. But I don't think that's true for youth. I think youth, like Cinderella, I mean, you can fantasize about anything when you're young.
Yeah, and a lot of them have had a taste, so they can relate in some sense. Sure.
In verse 4, it seems like there's a tumbling of ideas. You know, she's talking about, you know, like, we'll run away, and then he comes to the room, and then we are all happy, and then we remember. So it's just this thing.
Wait, hold on. You're getting overshadowed by someone else's. Hold on. I'm a host. I can mute. Hold on. Yes, it's a big mix of stuff, right? Is that what you're saying?
It's like a rush of memories. It's all jumble. Like she's being.
Yeah.
We run away, and then we come to some place, but then we're all happy together, and then we remember. So it's like something's happening now, but then we're remembering it, and then is that the idea, that rush jumble?
Yeah, it is, and I think that's the sense you're supposed to get from it. We're going to see it in other places as well. There's a lot of uncollected moments. This is not, again, it's reflecting someone in a very I don't want to use the word immature. That's not, because that sounds negative. Just someone in a less mature, less collected space. And so that comes across very much. There are, by the way, psukim and Tanakh that reflect a very similar tone. You have psukim. Yeah, you're going to say that?
Yes. There are places in, you know, in Torah where the sentence structure is so awkward that eventually you realize this is reflecting the state of mind mm-hmm. of the people in the situation.
Exactly.
The words are just tumbling out and they're coming out wrong.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, there's a whole bunch of places like that. Exactly what I was going to say.
Good.
Wonderful. Okay, I'm going to wish everybody a lovely week. And Bezrat Hashem, we'll see each other next week before Purim.